Good morning. I call the House Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum has been established. Today we are hearing from the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to discuss customized living services and assisted living facilities. In addition, we are going to discuss adult day services that are licensed by the Department of Human Services. First, we are going to approve the minutes from November 19th. Vice Chair Anderson, have you had time to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I move approval.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the minutes from November 19th, 2025, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. All right, first we will move to the presentation by the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I just want to point out that the Commissioner of Health has had a prior engagement and is going to need to leave early, so we're going to let him present first. Brooke Cunningham. So members, how we're going to do the discussion is when we get through the Department of Health, if we have specific questions for the Commissioner of Health, we're going to turn to that first. And then once we finish the presentations of both departments, we'll take public testimony at that point. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Commissioner Cunningham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, representatives, for having us here this morning, members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity this morning to tell you more about the facility's license under Chapter 144G, also known as the Assisted Living License Facilities. MDH is the agency generally responsible for ensuring the quality of care provided to residents of facilities and to persons needing support services in their homes. Now, to ground us, let me define an assisted living facility. An assisted living facility is a facility that provides sleeping accommodations and assisted living facilities do one or more, serve one or more adults, 18 and older. So assisted living services that they provide include helping residents with their activities of daily living, those things like bathing, toileting, feeding, dressing, medication administration as a nursing task, taking blood pressure or blood glucose for those who have diabetes. Again, medication management services, therapies and treatments, and preparation of specialized diets and assistance to residents with complicated eating problems. Again, assisted living facilities are housing plus health care. And they may include a secured dementia unit. So we license both assisted living and, which is the standard license, and assisted living with dementia care. So if a facility advertises or provides specialized dementia care or has a locked memory unit, it must have that dementia care license. On August 1st, 2021, Minnesota Assisted Living Licensure became effective, enabling MDH to license, survey, investigate, and enforce under Minnesota Statute 144G requirements. Keep in mind, this was happening in the midst of the pandemic, which placed a unique strain on the state's assisted living facilities, but we were able to implement these needed reforms even in that trying, difficult moment. So it feels important for me to say a couple of things up front around this. Again, under 144G, it tasks MDH with focusing on the health and safety of residents. We are certainly careful to notice potential indicators of fraud where we see them and work closely with other entities tasked with investigating potential fraud when we have any of those observations. And prior to this year, MDH was not mandated to report fraud or refer to other agencies, but we did that as part of our regular practice. You know, what shifted in 2021, as we noted on the side, was when we went to this licensing type, we shifted from housing with services to the assisted living licensure and certainly carry out with all due diligence that responsibility with those 2021 reforms. Let me run through what a number of those reforms were. We established a single license for assisted living facilities, streamlining the regulatory structure by creating the unified license type. We increased licensee responsibilities and accountability, heightening oversight and defining clear responsibilities for operators. We implemented physical plant and fire and safety requirements to strengthen our review of facility infrastructure and emergency preparedness standards. We required licensing for the actual providers themselves and accountability measures for those in leadership roles. We changed the survey from 3 years to 2 years, which increased our regulatory oversight, and we enhanced the resident bill of rights and expanded consumer protections. So all of these reforms allow us to increase our responsibility and accountability for licensees and to, again, ensure the safety of even the physical space, the facility. These reforms enhance the resident bill of rights and expanded consumer protection, such as allowing electronic monitoring devices and clarifying resident status under landlord-tenant law. The resident bill of rights contains 24 rights and the recourse for residents in all assisted living facilities in Minnesota. Many of these things will be implemented this January 1st, and with a new addition ensuring the right to a support person physically present at a resident's choosing, at times of the resident's choosing. These bill of rights include things as simple as courteous treatment to refusal of care, freedom from maltreatment, right to come and go freely, individual autonomy, right to furnish and decorate, a whole list of 24 rights that we're outlining will be implemented this January. To give you all a sense, when a licensure came into effect, MDH initially anticipated that about 1,300 to 1,500 of those housing with services licenses would convert to assisted living facilities. But what we've seen is that we have had growth in this space to respond to the need and the demand, and we have over 2,000 licensees in 2025. And certainly even back then initially, we had higher than anticipated conversion into assisted living. So when you all look at the bar charts there, you see in 2025, there are 2,328 assisted living facilities. They have a variety of capacity, some with five or fewer residents, some up to 17 or more residents. And so there's a clear upward trend in the number of total licensees. Reflection of about a 4 to 5% increase per year that we're seeing in growth in this space. So the numbers, of course, fluctuate. Some facilities open, some facilities close. Sometimes there are consolidations or changes in ownership. But the main takeaway from this graph and my comments are this is a large and growing industry, which means the need for consistent oversight and collaboration with local partners like fire chiefs more than ever. It is important to note that smaller assisted living facilities are often mislabeled as group homes and are frequently confused with other state licensed residential living settings that may provide similar housing and healthcare services. A licensed assisted living facility is a healthcare facility regardless of the size of the facility and the number of residents, which is why it is regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health. Just briefly, I won't discuss this in detail. This gives you some idea of the overview across our state in terms of total number of assisted living facilities per county, and we have it broken down by percent, and you see a dominance, of course, here in the metro with Hennepin and Ramsey. Now, as part of our regulatory duties, as I mentioned, as part of the licensure, went from a survey from every 3 years to every 2 years, and surveys are literally when we review the documentation, when we go on site. So when I say a survey, it is not what we might commonly think of a survey. It is a site visit. It is making sure folk are complying with our regulations and really complying sufficiently to prevent unacceptable health and safety risks to residents. So staff go through a thorough process, inspecting facility, evaluating resident well-being. They review staff training and resident records. They conduct interviews with staff and residents and family members. They look at the administration of medication, of bathing, of feeding, of attending to those activities of daily living. They certainly look at an infection control, pain management. I mentioned the facility, right? We want to make sure that there's fire safety, that there's an evacuation plan, that these facilities are ready in case that there's an emergency. For example, that they have egress windows, that they're cup they're kept in good repair, and that smoke alarms and fire extinguishers are in place. And certainly we also look to make sure that the kitchen and food code inspections are done properly to prevent foodborne illness. So again, surveys are the technical term for our on-site in-person inspections taking place every 2 years, looking at the requirements of 144G. We, as part of the surveys, do not inspect billing or financial statements as part of those survey inspections routinely. So while we are on site, though, we pay attention, right? We are careful to notice if there might be potential signs or indicators of fraud. And we work, if we see the anything that might raise our suspicion, we work closely with other entities tasked with investigating potential fraud to share those observations. So let's talk a little bit about our credentialing verifications when a new facility wants to come online. It all starts with a provisional license application. NDH reviews a compliance history, looks at DHS exclusion lists, looks for any irregularities, their verification items such as IRS forms, background studies, the Board of Executives for Long-Term Services and Supports we look at, workers' comp and liability insurance. Certainly we verify through the Board of Nursing as well, and again, we review the facility. So there are a number of requirements that a facility must meet to get a new license for assisted living before they begin to operate, and these items that I mentioned are just some of these items that are reviewed at the time of a new license. They are also reviewed during a renewal and change of ownership. And if a provisional license is granted, it is effective for up to 1 year from the date when the license is issued. Licensees must provide notice to MDH within 2 days of beginning to provide assisted living services. And if the provisional licensee actually does not provide services during the provisional year, the provisional license expires and they would have to apply for a new license. These are the ways that first and foremost, we regulate these as healthcare facilities. The provisional license is an important way for MDH to verify that an operator is able to safely provide assisted living services to its residents and to ensure program integrity. Since the passage of assisted living licensure, we've continued to work with a bipartisan group of legislators, providers, and residents, advocates to update the law to better serve residents in these facilities. And so we always like to take a full approach and engage all of the stakeholders interested in this important space when these changes happened. Certainly in 2023, the legislature directed MDH and DHS to consult with assisted living licensees who provide customized living and were smaller than 11 residents. It's very difficult for smaller providers in healthcare at any type to really meet regulatory requirements. And you all, as a legislature, asked us to work on small providers and to certainly provide the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over assisted living licensure and customized living with recommendations, including draft legislation, to reduce the regulatory burden for small providers. And what happened after that 2023 directive was after months of discussion with providers, resident advocates, other stakeholders, this led to bipartisan changes passed in 2024, allowing for the relocation of assisted living facility while maintaining the same license and provide smaller assisted living facilities with more flexibility for their food service requirements. So this is work that we were happy to see and participate, and thank you for the ability to help support our small providers. As I've already shared, MDH has worked to license assisted living facilities under 144G, task us with focusing on the health and safety as residents, as stated before. So protections for health, like medication administration, checking blood pressure, checking blood glucose, protections for safety, like making sure there's an egress window and an evacuation plan. We are careful to notice potential indicators of fraud when we see them. And as I mentioned before, work with other entities tasked with investigating fraud to share those observations. We are also not currently aware of any credible allegations of financial fraud within the assisted living space. Because MDH is charged with the health and safety of assisted living facilities, let me share with you some examples of how MDH may identify and report any fraudulent activity. One example is when the facility receives payment for nursing services, but we go on site and through observation and interviews and document reviews, there are questions raised that show unlicensed personnel are actually the ones implementing that care rather than a nurse, an RN or LPN. Or we notice that a facility is supposed to be administering services to a resident, but we're not seeing that resident get those services, or perhaps we question whether the resident actually needs those services. In those cases, MDH makes referrals for further investigation to the appropriate agency. And this slide shows who those appropriate agencies are. And so we meet, of course, with DHS. We regularly communicate with our partners in the state enterprise to discuss assisted living regulation. There's frequent contact between our agencies regarding licensure status, any questions, concerns, any updates, anything that comes up on a survey that we might be questioning. Certainly, there are also referral procedures for possible fraudulent activities to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and certainly to DLI and the Minnesota Attorney General, in addition to DHS's Office of Inspector General. In the last quarter, we have communicated with each other on a number of things. Some examples would be change of ownership, updates on renewals, license relocations, closure, capacity changes in these facilities, communications, training opportunities. We make sure we provide a report each month concerning licensee statuses related to renewals. And certainly, as we look across our complaints, you know, there are complaints around financial exploitation, and we certainly push those into the appropriate partners. There are also complaints around drug diversion or theft of personal property that have come to our attention. And again, particularly if there are any signs of potential financial crime or any other sort of criminal investigation, we move those both to BCA's Financial Crime and Fraud section and DHS's OIG program. And then just so that everyone here in the public is aware, we want to hear from folk, right? That's one of the ways in which, complaints are come to our attention, right? We want people to be safe. We want people to be healthy. And so if there's anything that is coming to mind for the public or residents in the facilities, certainly there's the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, and I've provided the phone number in the slide. And then there's certainly you can report to us through our general licensing concern. And so we have an Office of Health Facility Complaints, and that certainly gets complaints about any sort of violations, issues with inadequate care, violations of licensing standards, issues related to discharge or termination of services for residents. And so MDH staff triage the complaints, and certainly if it's not in our jurisdiction, as some of the things that I've just discussed are not, we refer them to the appropriate agency for follow-up. Regarding the reports of possible fraudulent activities, because MDH is tasked with life and safety, MDH will get allegations related to care and services and then identify any other concerns such as fraud or financial exploitation, refer them to the appropriate entities. We have some resources in the deck for you all to click through, but really thank you for inviting me here today for this relatively brief presentation. You all know the mission of the Minnesota Department of Health is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, no matter their background and certainly no matter where they live. and that includes protecting the health and safety of Minnesotans who live in assisted living facilities. So thank you all. I'm certainly happy to take any questions, and thank you for your interest.
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. I think because I know she has to leave in 10 minutes, we'll do member questions first for Dr. Cunningham, and then we'll move on to DHS. So I would like to start, first of all, thank you for your presentation. And I think for those of us who don't serve on the Health and Human Services or the health committees, it was surprising to see that, well, I certainly understand why your focus is on the health and safety and your licensure procedures, that there's nothing required for you to also look at the financial health and billing records and the financial piece of these businesses. Because clearly, if they are mismanaging funds or if they're not able to continue running, it will impact the health and safety of the residents. So I think it should be a component of your work as part of licensure. So would you want that task? Do you think somehow the financial review of these licensure providers is being handled somewhere else already? Could you just speak to that? Thank you.
Certainly, we follow what was outlined in terms of state statute for our responsibility in this space. And certainly, you know, that is a question that a lot of people have interest in asking. I will say for us as the health department, who does not process claims around healthcare billing, our role, we really do focus on what we see on site when we come in. Many of our members of our regulatory team are public health nurses. They are clinically trained. They are looking at, are people being taken care of and are they being taken care of well? And are their activities of daily living being met? Are they safe in the facilities? And then we have other folks who are engineers on our teams, right, who are really helping us look at the facilities. So currently, with the staff that we have, we meet all of the regulatory requirements that have been outlaid for us in statute. And as I mentioned, when something, because we are there observing, if there's something that seems concerning, we lift it up and we pass it over to our partners who do handle the billing for those services and who do investigate any sort of criminal activity.
Thank you. So one of the points on slide 11 is that there was an effort to allow assisted living facilities to relocate while retaining the same license. Could you explain more about why that was important to the either the providers or to the department? Like, what is driving that change?
So thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, I could have our Health Regulation Division follow up about the process that came together within the work group. So certainly, this wasn't a unilateral MDH decision. This was through sort of bipartisan work and multiple stakeholders to say what would reduce the burden of on small facilities. So in the work group's recommendation at the time was to focus on giving those small facilities for whom applying for licenses, they're small, applying for licensors, of course, is always a lot of work for any small facility, but how could we support them? And what came out of the work group was that recommendation. And so we moved that forward based on the recommendation from the work group.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Timian, Legislative Director for the Department of Health, just to add a little more context, the small providers are, would often be in residences that they didn't own. So if you don't own the residence and your landlord decides that they're not going to renew your lease or that it's time to move on, this was just a way to create a process for them to have an orderly relocation of that service within the county or contiguous area to the location of the previous facility, just so that they didn't have to start exactly from square one, but of course it still had the same inspection and survey requirements and everything that still had to be met. It was just to create a little clarity for these small providers if they had to move their location.
Thank you. Both of those answers were helpful. So to further drill down on that just one more time, if they move because their lease was up, do then they go back to a provisional license at the new facility, or do they retain the same license? So, like, is there an inspection after just 1 year at the new facility, or do they have that two-year window?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would need to look exactly at the requirements, but my understanding is that there would be an inspection before they could operate in the new facility as well. It's, you know, somewhat like provisional, but I can get you more details about how exactly that inspection process works.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So you said in your presentation that this is not group homes. When I think of assisted living facilities, I generally think they're large, they're generally seniors, right? So you said that these are not group homes. And can you explain what is a small provider? I assume that that's a group home. But
so Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. I think the reason that I lifted it up is there are a lot of small facilities that all get sort of bunched together and called group homes. And some are assisted living and some are not. And so certainly there are a number of small assisted living facilities. And there's one slide that sort of outlines that. But they get lumped in to a lot of other sort of supervised residential facilities that we do not regulate because these are health care facilities. They have, again, the public health nursing. And so that is why this is our space. And other facility types are regulated by other agencies, such as the Department of Human Services.
Anyone else? Vice Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lee Pinto. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. I want to clarify the point earlier that so MDH does not oversee financial issues, which makes sense. You're focused on health and safety. I just want to confirm that regarding when there are public dollars being spent, which I know is a particular interest of all of us, there is oversight. I guess that would be with your partner agency, with DHS, but perhaps Commissioner or Ms. Timian, you could just clarify that. And I mean, it's not that it's not being looked at. It's just it's not your agency because you're focused on a different thing.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative Pinto, thank you so much. Yes, that is a good summary of our space.
All right. Thank you for coming to the committee. We appreciate it. I'm sure we'll have some follow-up questions. And we'll now look forward to hearing from Wendy Underwood, Deputy Commissioner. DHS. I'm sorry. Oh, we've got quite a group coming from DHS. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and committee members. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I serve as the temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for inviting DHS here today to present and for your ongoing support of fraud prevention activities. DHS has a zero tolerance for fraud. And our state is right to be proud of the support we provide to children, people with disabilities, and older adults so that they can live healthy lives in community. And to protect these services, we have to get ahead and keep ahead of the criminals that have been preying on our system. As an administrative agency, DHS must follow the evidence, stop payments as soon as possible, whenever credible allegations of fraud are established, and refer cases to our law enforcement partners so that they can prosecute the criminals. I appear before you today for the fifth time with a commitment on working on solutions together to address fraud in Minnesota. Fraud is not a partisan issue. People of all races, ethnicities, and incomes commit fraud. It takes all of us working together, the bipartisan legislature, providers, community members, and agencies to design programs with strong controls to ensure that we serve the people well and protect taxpayer money. I hope that we can continue to work together to meet this goal. When I was here last September, Governor Walz had just announced Executive Order 2510. Under his direction, DHS has accelerated and expanded our actions. Since my last visit, we have disenrolled 800 inactive providers in high-risk programs. This action reduces the administrative challenges DHS has in overseeing providers who are not providing services. DHS increased the risk level for 9 additional types of services, bringing the high-risk service number to 14. This action gives us more tools in these 14 high-risk services to tighten oversight. The new types of actions that we can do are pre-enrollment site visits, unannounced site visits, criminal background checks, and fingerprinting of those with an ownership stake. DHS signed a contract with a third-party vendor to conduct enhanced prepayment review of fee-for-service claims for the 14 high-risk services to identify risks before we pay claims. And at the beginning of December, we announced a 2-year pause on licenses for new home and community-based service providers. The growth in licensed service providers has far outpaced the growth in participants. A pause with an exception process to assure Minnesotans can access the services they need will allow DHS to provide the necessary monitoring and oversight of existing providers. And just yesterday, we announced that effective February 1st, we will implement a temporary 2-year pause on adult day center licenses, which provide adult day services. And there will be more program integrity actions coming. Over the past 5 years, we've seen a 43% increase in licensed capacity for adult day centers, while the number of participants has only increased by about 7%. With this temporary moratorium, DHS will work with counties, tribal nations, and managed care organizations on exceptions to the licenses to ensure that people can access the services they need. Chair Robbins, John and James are prepared to provide more information on adult day centers as well as customized living services.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you so much, Chair Robbins. John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So I will start us with customized living, given the order of the slide deck. So this is just a summary slide here indicating the nature of the service. I'll get into more detail on the next slide. So I think the first thing to clarify, given MDH's presentation, is that customized living as a Medicaid benefit really is referred to often as assisted living. That is really the type of service in the facility that people think of commonly in the community. So customized living is really the name as a Medicaid benefit for assisted living. It's a home and community-based service that pays for services that are typically provided in those assisted living settings. In addition to Medicaid funding, Medicaid is a significant payer of long-term services and supports generally, but there are other payers like Veterans Affairs, private pay, and other forms of insurance that do cover assisted living as well. Though Medicaid is a large payer in this space. So more specifically, what is customized living? It's, again, a home and community-based waiver service. It's available on several different waivers within our Medicaid program here in Minnesota, including the elderly waiver, the brain injury waiver for people with disabilities, and the community access for disability inclusion waiver, also known as CADI. The service is delivered through distinct health-related and supportive components, and it's based on an individualized service plan, which is informed by an assessment, which could either be done through the assessment provided as a part of the elderly waiver or the MIN Choices assessment through the disability waivers that I mentioned earlier. Some of the different services that are included as a part of the benefit are assistance with activities of daily living. As Commissioner Cunningham mentioned, she described a lot of this, but some of it may bear repeating, so I'll just go into a few details here. In addition, assistance with mental health, cognitive or behavioral concerns, that's another important piece of this as we look at overall well-being and health. Health-related assistance, things like, you know, assistance with self-administration of medication or connection to other health services that might be helpful. In addition, home management tasks. This is, again, a home and community-based service. So if there are kind of low-level home management items that folks need help with, that's also part of the benefit or a service that's offered. In addition to non-medical transportation. So since some of these folks will grapple and members of the program grapple with isolation, transportation is a part of what's paid for, and general socialization, having somebody, again, to help with different needs and interaction generally with people in the community is of benefit to particularly older adults and folks with disabilities as a part of the service. To be eligible for the service, someone needs to be eligible for one of the waivers that I mentioned, BI, CADI, or EW, and they have to have an assessed need for one of the regularly scheduled services, either health-related or supportive in nature that I just mentioned. And there are a variety of different combinations of those services that could be provided as a part of the benefit, again, based on assessment through the elderly waiver or the MN Choices assessment through a disability waiver. I think with that, we are moving on to some of the provider requirements. I think MDH went into a lot of detail here in terms of the licensing. This is not a DHS-licensed provider setting. We are a payer more exclusively in this benefit or service, though I think it's important to mention that we do, as Commissioner Cunningham noted, meet monthly and regularly kind of cadenced meetings, but also have more frequent meetings if there are issues with respect to certain provider behaviors or issues or concerns about licensure or payment behavior. So those are things that we do process with MDH and just talk generally about questions, concerns, issues that we need to coordinate on as agencies. Moving on to the next slide, a few things with respect to program integrity specifically. So the benefit is structured in a pretty careful way. There are, of course, the requirements for the MN Choices assessment and the elderly waiver assessment to inform what exactly the person's needs are and what services are appropriate. That will inform the service plan or the care plan that informs an individualized rate. So I'll just lean on this for a second, because what providers get paid for this service, it varies person to person. It depends on the clinical need, the assessment, and the care plan that's developed that flows from that assessment. So case managers within counties or lead agencies, including managed care plans, in the case of an elderly waiver member, would be in charge of approving that care plan and would also be authorizing the services provided that are approved as a part of that care plan. So just to note here again, prior authorizations do come before the billing occurs, and there are strict limits in terms of those authorizations and what providers can bill for. So they would not be permitted to bill in excess of the services or amounts that are authorized by the case manager. We also have an assisted living report card that measures and reports on the quality of individual services or service providers, rather, so that people can go onto our website and look at quality ratings and be able to select a program or a provider that meets their needs. It's a joint effort between the Department of Human Services, Aging and Adult Services Division, and the Minnesota Board on Aging. So again, we encourage folks to go to that website, take a look at the ratings, and this is generally our resource for people to make informed choices about providers of this particular benefit and providers in these settings. So I think with that, we'll move on to, should we pause?
Questions.
For questions on this particular benefit? Sure.
Thank you. I think we can finish the presentation and then we'll take questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. All right, moving on to adult day services. A bit more about the second service kind of in focus today. So the goals of adult day services are broadly to provide a meaningful set of age-appropriate tasks, materials, activities, supports, responsive again to a person's individual goals, interests, and needs. Many of the people that receive this service or are approved for it are older adults in Minnesota, though some people below the age of 65. With disabilities do also receive adult day services. One of the main goals is to provide community integration opportunities. Again, many older adults and people with disabilities who are at home in the community really benefit from and need interaction broadly in the community. It's really in alignment, this service, with the vision and mission of DHS to really help people thrive in their communities. So there's social and physical interaction at the centers. There are meals and snacks covered depending on the length of time that people are in the facilities daily. I would also note that there are up to 12 hours of service permitted per day in the service in the service line, and at least 2 hours required. I will note that more commonly, folks usually receive 6 to 8 hours of service a day, and if the service is more than 4.5 hours a day, adult day will cover a meal as well. One other component of this, in addition to the benefit and health and wellness to the person who receives the service, it's really important as a source of support and respite for primary caregivers. So I think for a lot of us who have older adults in our households or families, children, people with disabilities, we understand the benefit of having an opportunity to take care of household business, to work, and to have a place for a loved one, a member of the household, to go and receive support and service. And that's really a major goal of adult day services. So it's making a difference not only for people who struggle with isolation and have health-related and social needs, but also for their family and members and loved ones, people in their households. Some of the health services that are included as a part of this service are also consulting with registered nurses to monitor their health. Again, assistance with self-administration of medications, making sure that folks are monitoring and taking meds as they're supposed to be, offering exercise that's appropriate for the needs of folks in the setting. That's an important wellness benefit and an activity that many members of the programs who receive the service receive. In addition, also providing with connections to services, including health services and referrals as needed. There are other cultural kind of enrichment activities. You could have speakers that provide health coaching, different performances or activities or movement exercises that help folks, again, with life-enriching activity. Again, for people who spend a lot of time or are at risk of spending a lot of time in isolation and need that kind of engagement, both physically but also socially. Moving on to the next slide. So I mentioned the different waivers with respect to customized living, where folks qualify for the service. With respect to adult day, they're available on the four MA disability waivers, so CADI, CAC, BI, the usual that I mentioned here, in addition to the elderly waiver, which I mentioned in the customized living context, in addition to alternative care and the essential community supports program. As I mentioned, the service itself is individualized based on an assessment and need for care and service. Both health and social are included in that. I mentioned the maximum in terms of billing per day is 12 hours, and a variety of different services in terms of supervision, care, assistance, training, activities included. Just as a note, in terms of overall number of providers that are licensed, we have 104 licensed currently in Minnesota as of the 12th of this month, December 2025, and 25 pending applications. So that's just a bit of context about the nature of the service. And I think with that, I'll pause, turn it over to James to talk a bit more about program integrity.
Good morning.
Good morning. So please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James Clark, Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. So DHS conducts licensing oversight of adult day centers to ensure compliance with state rules and statutes. First, we conduct pre-licensing visits for all centers prior to granting licenses. At pre-licensing site visits, licensors review the physical location and safety requirements and ensure that centers meet all other applicable legal requirements. After a program is licensed, licensors provide technical assistance to license holders and conduct unannounced licensing reviews every 2 years. If noncompliance is found, licensors can issue licensing sanctions such as a correction order, a conditional license, or a revocation. Over the past 2 years, DHS has done site visits to 85% of adult day centers in the state. In addition to licensing reviews, DHS investigates adult day centers to make sure that tax dollars are being spent appropriately. Now more than ever, we are using data to identify billing outliers and conduct surveillance of adult day centers to monitor activity and attendance. We have a project in place as we speak where we are doing surveillance and using data to target providers that need further review. At the direction of the governor's office, in fact, we've pulled in staff from other state agencies to increase capacity to help with surveillance and investigations of adult day providers. Investigations into adult day providers are ongoing, and if we find credible allegations of fraud, we will suspend payments and refer people and businesses to law enforcement. It's important to note that adult day services paid by medical assistants require prior authorization by case managers, and there are limits on the number of hours that can be billed per day. counties and county case managers play an important role in Medicaid oversight. I've said it before, but Medicaid oversight is a shared responsibility. The role of county case managers is to monitor their clients and make sure that appropriate services are being delivered. To that end, we prioritize tips that we receive from case managers, and I want more case managers to reach out to DHS with tips if they are seeing fraud, waste, or abuse or maltreatment with their clients that are receiving adult day services. Quality tips are a crucial component of fraud detection and prevention. We'll go to the next slide. So DHS is implementing a pause on new adult day center licenses. The pause will go into effect on February 1st, 2026, and will be in effect for 2 years. The reason for the pause is that the capacity for adult day centers far exceeds the current and expected need. In other words, at this time, we just don't need additional adult day centers in the state. We have excess capacity or excess space for program recipients that would like to access adult day services. Pausing expansion of new adult day centers will allow staff to focus on providing oversight of existing businesses and protecting the health and safety of recipients. So we're shifting staff from reviewing new applications and getting new centers up and running, shifting their focus so that they can squarely focus on oversight of existing adult day businesses. It's important to note that to ensure that people have access to adult day services, an exceptions process will be available. Counties, managed care organizations, and tribes will be able to identify if there is a need and request, identify and request for additional adult day centers if there is a demonstrated need for additional centers to be opened in our state. I think it's important to note, as the slide points out, for this service, a moratorium was already in place, and I think it was in 2021. Which prevented new authorizations for people under 55 that are receiving coverage through disability waivers. So really this service, when you think about adult day services, this is really a service for older adults and seniors. One thing I would point out related to the adult day licensing moratorium. So when I say Medicaid oversight is a shared responsibility, we share and work with our federal partners for Medicaid oversight. So last week, CMS asked us to implement additional enrollment pauses for additional services. So I anticipate that we will be implementing additional licensing and enrollment pauses in the near future. These licensing and enrollment pauses are an important tool that we can use to make sure and prevent provider oversaturation and the problems that come along with provider oversaturation. That's all I have for that slide.
Thank you for your testimony. I will start the questioning. So you talked about the growth of capacity in the adult day programs, and maybe we'll need our colleague from the Department of Health to join us. I'm not sure. But because the Department of Health licenses the assisted living facilities, but you oversee the payment for customized living services at DHS, it's sort of a bifurcated responsibility. And has there been a similar concern about capacity in assisted living facilities that you see in adult day services?
So thank you, Chair. What I would say is certainly I think we're broadly looking at capacity relative to utilization and the rise in numbers of people who are being served. So we're always concerned in watching the corresponding nature of those numbers. I think the increase over the last several years, both in terms of the number of people served and the number of facilities licensed, has, in terms of the share or the percentage increase year over year, they aren't terribly out of line. I think the figure that we're more focused on is really looking at the increase in payments overall. And as I noted in my presentation, I think that that's really multifactorial in that every person has an individualized rate that is based on an assessment and a care plan that a waiver case manager or a health plan will approve. And then there's a service authorization with the service that's provided in that setting. So that's kind of where I think we're focused in terms of the increase that really is notable with the service line.
Thank you. So to follow up on that, can you send me the capacity numbers for assisted living similar to what you've outlined for adult day services?
Yeah, I think we can do that.
Okay.
That's a yeah, very good point. So Medicaid, though, it is a major payer within the customized living or assisted living space. Other payers are involved, too, so there may be interactions with other payers that we wouldn't be privy to.
Yes, I understand. But I think understanding the general capacity issue for both programs is really important. Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have a similar question, just stated more simply. I'm trying to understand how the adult day services could, the capacity of providers could exceed the need from folks. I would think that the providers would be something that would be generated by the perceived need in the community as opposed to people setting up themselves as providers and then looking for somebody to fill those spaces. Like, how do you get established as a adult day provider in the first place if there's nobody that you need to take care of?
Sure, I can start. And then James, if you want to add more. So depending on the service, there may not be a requirement to have a general service need demonstrated for a provider to be approved or to seek a licensure. So they may set up a facility without a demonstrated community need or without a needs assessment. That said, part of what generated the provider enrollment moratorium that we announced just yesterday was as a result of a concern related to that, that if you have an excess of providers or provider capacity relative to need or utilization, that's a situation where I think program integrity risk rises.
Could I add maybe something?
Yes, General Clark.
So Representative Hudson, I mean, I think this is a very important point. And I think as a state, we need to look at potential needs assessments across the board, right, for new Medicaid businesses that enter our programs. I think, unfortunately, the adult day program did have a needs assessment that was required, but that was removed from statute last session. I'm trying to figure out why that was the case. But I think, you know, I've talked about, you know, we need additional resources and technology on the back end to investigate, but we need to keep, you know, unqualified, unserious providers. Like you're saying, like, why would a business open up if there's not the need for their services? So what can we do as a state to figure out how to prevent those unserious providers from opening up in the first place? So one thing I thought about and kicked around is just a general needs assessment for all new Medicaid businesses in this state, right? You need to demonstrate that there's a need for your services before we allow you to open up and get licensed. I think that would help with this excess capacity issue that we're seeing, because when you have a marketplace, when there's excess capacity, there's not a way for you to drum up legitimate business, then you're gonna try to figure out if profit is your motive, you're going to figure out ways to drum up illegitimate businesses. So that's why we've seen allegations, and we're investigating allegations of kickbacks in the adult day program area, because when you have a flood or excess of providers in a marketplace and you can't, you know, make money the legitimate way, you're going to try to think about how to make it illegitimately and drum up business. So this idea of a kind of a blanket needs assessment, I think, on the front door is something that we should consider as a state for new Medicaid businesses.
Thank you, General Clark. I'd like to just piggyback on that answer for a minute, because multiple whistleblower reports that I have received and some I've spoken to directly do allege kickbacks in this space. So people who have opened, especially these newer providers, offering kickbacks to get people from other adult day services to instead come to their new adult day service business. Have you also seen evidence of that? And when you see evidence of those kickbacks, what do you do?
Yes, yeah, so licensors and investigators have seen, we've seen allegations of kickbacks. And so we investigate, right? But kickbacks are difficult to prove and investigate, right? When you have a business, an employee, and a recipient kind of in on the scam, right? They're exchanging money between each other, right? It's hard to kind of pierce that veil and figure out, like, well, what's really going on here, right? Like, it's one thing to investigate, and a recipient's like, yep, I've never heard of this company. What are you talking about? But if they're receiving a financial incentive, right, to access this business, they're probably not going to be forthcoming about the fact whether or not they're receiving services. So we do investigate. If we establish credible allegations of fraud, then we refer to the Attorney General's office.
And put a stop payment.
And we suspend payments when we see credible allegations of fraud. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you. So to be clear, you are now suspending payments in credible allegations of fraud every time you see them?
Yes. And I think if you look at, so are we in, the answer is yes. And if you look, in the interest of public transparency, we are now publishing on DHS's public-facing website all of the numbers of stop payments that we are implementing, all the numbers of monetary recovery that we're, taking action on, all the number of open investigations. And you can see there's been a significant increase in payment suspensions over the past year as opposed to years past. So, yes, we are aggressively suspending payments whenever our investigators see evidence of fraud.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have several questions, but one. Is it a crime for someone to take a kickback? Because we know that's going on, and, you know, for the person that's receiving the dollars. Is it a crime?
I don't know. I can look at the statute. I know we have the kickback law is new as of last year. So we can get you a legal opinion on that. But
if you wouldn't mind, our counsel for the committee would like to respond.
Madam Chair, members, the kickback law did pass last session, and it does apply to both those who would be paying the kickback and those who would receive the kickback. So someone receiving a kickback would be potentially guilty under that new crime.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Andrews.
Thank you. I think that's publicizing that widely is going to help, because that's where a big part of this problem is. I'm trying to get the numbers. So I saw something on, I think it was Channel 9, and they said that the active, the growth in licenses, or the growth in people using the adult daycare is like 25% in the last 5 years. This is from Channel 9. The growth in active licenses is 55%, and then the new apps was like 283%. Is that accurate? So the growth over the last 5 years in adult daycare is 25%? Is that? I saw that on a Channel 9 story.
Mr. Conley.
Thank you, Chair. So I'd have to confirm that number, but it sounds broadly in line with the numbers that we have, and certainly the number of, the capacity of adult day services has outpaced the number of people, for example, who are using the service. So we've seen increases in both of those metrics, but certainly the license capacity has outpaced, the increase in license capacity has outpaced the utilization of the service, which led to the action yesterday. So that's an accurate characterization.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Andrews.
Thank you. So we have a 25% more people currently using adult daycare than were 4 years ago. This is what I saw from the news story. That's a big red flag. I mean, huge, huge red flag. And, of course, and we see all these other people trying to get into the space. And, you know, I guess my question is, at what point did, you know, DHS notice this? Was it before the last 3 or 4 months? And it had to have been ongoing over the last 5 or 6 years, seeing, you know, this is a huge red flag. And so at what point were we looking at going, hey, this doesn't go up? You know, we don't have 25% more people that need adult daycare in the state.
Mr. Conley.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Representative Anderson, I think that is a really important point. So I just want to clarify, I did come across two data points here that I think are helpful. So you are correct that the license capacity has outpaced the need in the last several years. So we've seen that the number of participants has grown by about 7% in the last 10 years. License capacity has grown by about 43%. So we absolutely share your concern. What I would say, and certainly others can join me here in response, is that we have included this service as one of the 14 that's high risk. Mm-hmm. We have been looking at it in the last year very closely along with others, including billing trends. I think this is in line with some of the conversations we've had with the committee historically about, certainly we wish that we had identified any concerning trend sooner, but I think we've kind of communicated that our tools were really not up to, I think, the enormity of what we were facing. And so what we have done this year is really pivoted from a tip-based investigation model to one that is more proactive in terms of how we stop payments, how we use data analytics to investigate what might be causing rises in payments, and looking at the different variables that could be at work. And certainly one of the risk factors is license capacity or provider capacity that exceeds community need or demand or utilization of the service. So absolutely, I think it's something we're looking very closely at. We took action yesterday and are pivoting to use more advanced tools as the different schemes evolve in front of us. So
just one
very quickly.
What are the dollars? You know, you talked about 7% more people using them, but the capacity, they're using it more, the billing's got, what's been the growth in this program over the last 5 years, let's say, and the dollars spent on this program?
Mr. Conley.
What's the dollar amount? We can't find it, so.
So I don't have that in front of me, but we can certainly get you that number. It's a very reasonable data point to request.
Thank you. I would like that. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to go to Representative Greenman. Oh, Commissioner Gandhi, did you want to say something as well?
Yes, thank you, Chair Robbins. I wanted to point out just a couple things to add on to what John said. The growth in, to Representative Anderson's question, the growth in the number of people, again, I just want to remind everybody that these are people that have been seen by a case manager. The case manager has identified the need for the services, authorized the services, authorized the amount of services. So that is happening, and we need to do everything John is talking about, and that's what we've been focused on for the last 10 months, is expanding the use of data analytics to watch these trends, to look at outliers and trends, and the controls that the services had in them when they were passed with the legislature and whether that's sufficient or not for the program. And so that's why we have these 14 high-risk programs, and we will continue with our capacity going absolutely as fast as we can, going through each and every one, taking action to strengthen program integrity and to protect people. Because when these dollars are being siphoned off from our system, they're not going to the people that actually need the services.
Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this conversation. And, you know, I am not on human services. In the veteran space, we've had a lot of conversations about adult day and how it has allowed folks in a less institutional setting to get some care and have their caregivers get some support. And so I think the question, like, it'd be interesting to know, I assume some of the increase is related to the fact that we just have baby boomers who are now entering, like, we have a demographic tsunami, whatever, that we are facing. And so in the next 10 years, I mean, we've been hearing about this for the last 25, like, in the next 10 years, the needs for services of that aging population are going to increase. And so it's a good conversation we're having now about, like, how we want to care for folks in an institutional setting, like in a nursing home or an assisted living, how we want to transition folks and keep, my understanding is this is one way to keep people in the home, is to provide some services, especially relief for those caregivers. But I actually had a different question because, and I appreciate the conversation between Representative Hudson and Mr. Clark, because this, when I was reading about, like, particularly in adult day, and this idea that there is more capacity than demand, it did seem to me that we, in some ways, are treating this like a service that's provided in the market. Like, not, that's not how we're paying for it, but we are providing it that way. And so, like, the law, the supply and demand, are the principles we use and when we have outsourced the provision of a lot of these services, which is different than when we do in the veterans home, right, which it's paid for and provided by the Minnesota, the Minneapolis Veterans Home in my district. But it's different here because what we've said is we are going to create, we're going to use private providers and in this case, public payers. The question, and so when I was reading about kickbacks, which I am glad we took action on, but some of the kickback behavior in the private sector would just look like market forces, right? Like charging less for your services. In if you are a business trying to get customers, you would charge less. And so I think that is not to say we should change the way we do it, but I think the incentive structure we have set up by sort of treating this as a quasi-private provider with public payers does raise all these questions of, well, how are we regulating supply and demand of, how are we making sure that the supply meets the demand? What you're proposing, Clark, and I think what you're saying, Representative Hudson, is, well, we should have that regulated. We should decide as a government, which I agree with, but I do think we should just think about how we're looking at these services because to say, well, so the government is going to decide how many providers we're going to have in this space, which is, I think, what we probably are getting to, is not getting the benefit of private providers competing against each other. So then it's like, well, why are we then using private providers? And there may be a lot of good reasons, but I just think, to me, this comes from, some of this conversation comes back to the very acute issue we're talking about, which is how do we create more front-end policy? How do we create more checks and, frankly, more bureaucracy? I think that the bigger question we should be asking is the incentive structure we've built into these systems with a plethora of private providers, no public do we have public providers? I know in the VA system, but what would that look like? Are we having the same problem in the public provider space, and how are we looking at that? Because I think if we want to get to the root of the problem, we have to look at the incentive structures of the markets we've set up.
Thank you. To that point, I just want to make a comment, and I was going to comment after your original comment, Inspector General, but I do think this is an important conversation that we as the legislature will be having ongoing. And my concern is that when the department has the ability to regulate and approve these applications, why on earth are you approving all these applications that basically fill out a form? Why have you allowed it to get so out of whack? And I think that's really important because the providers try to enter the market, but if there aren't, if you know there isn't demand, why are you just greenlighting all these providers to start billing Medicaid? Like, I think the department has enabled some of this fraud by approving basically hundreds of providers that aren't necessary. And I'm glad to see the pauses happening, but I think we have to look at this across all programs because my concern is in assisted living, this is also going on. And that's why I want that capacity demand number. We clearly, as Commissioner Gandhi said, have people in our communities who have needs and we want to make sure they're being addressed. But we shouldn't be putting the cart before the horse and approving hundreds and hundreds of providers when we don't have on the case management demand side, case managers signaling that we need those providers. So could you address why all those were approved?
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I agree. We need a system that is balanced properly. Just last year, we got the ability to put temporary moratoriums in place. Before that, we're given the directive and an authority to approve providers based on what's in statute. And when we are not doing that, or when we have had a glut of providers coming into the market, in fact, DHS faced a lot of pressure from legislators and the public on not going fast enough and not getting enough providers licensed or approved or enrolled as providers. So I think I go back to my opening comments where I say I really want to work on this together. I think the legislature, in a bipartisan way, needs to look at how we set up providers, what tools we give agencies to approve or deny providers, and that we are creating the right incentives and balance in the marketplace.
So who was pressuring you to approve providers?
So it would be a whole host of legislators and providers. So when there are people wanting to enter the market, licensure or approval or certification is seen as a barrier to entry. And we would get people saying, my application has been in for X number of weeks, X number of months. You need to, you know, we need you to go faster. People need services. And so I've been at the state long enough that I've seen sort of the ebbs and flows of this.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there are a couple of things that are puzzling me a little bit about all of this. You know, as Representative Greenman pointed out, I'm a boomer. Boomers are leading edge of the boomers are hitting 80, the age at which we increasingly need care. It's not a linear function. So it doesn't surprise me at all that we're suddenly seeing an increase, significant increase in demand. That's going to continue for at least the next decade. These are very customized, very labor-intensive services. And one of the things that's kind of puzzling me is that, and I've followed this for a while, I have constituents who need these services. I've spent time with some of the longstanding provider organizations like Opportunity Partners, which is located in an area that used to be in my district. And what I've always been told by providers is that it's very difficult to find personal care attendants, the people who actually do this work. The legislature has increased the pay of people doing this work significantly, but there has never been enough people available to do all of this work. People who need these services will tell me that they wait, you know, 3, 4, 5 months just to get a personal care attendant assigned to them. And so I am having trouble jiving that reality with this, you know, provision, this sudden fluctuation in the number of provider organizations. I'm hearing that there's a lot of churn in the business, that longstanding organizations are dropping out. It's never been a lucrative business, and other ones are coming in. And so one of the questions I'm wondering is if part of this churn is just new organizations coming in to backfill for the ones that are leaving the business. But the biggest thing is that just and I think this is a red flag, is how are we seeing this huge increase in the number of organizations that want to provide these services at the same time that we've never been able to recruit enough workers to actually do the work. And also in an era where historically a high percentage of the people who do this work have been first-generation immigrants. And we're losing a big part of that potential workforce. But have you guys had a chance to kind of dig into the underlying dynamics to see, you know, how much just churn there is among the organizations, and is the employment situation improving? Are there actually enough workers to staff these organizations that are starting up and provide services? I'm confused.
Thank you. Who would like to take that? Mr. Conley.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins. Maybe I'll begin with the fact that broadly, I think when we talk about home and community-based services, there is a workforce shortage. That is a fact. And I can understand how that doesn't really comport with some of the comments and concerns about license capacity. So sometimes, even if you have license capacity for a particular service, like adult day, that's outpacing demand or need for the service, you can still have a broader home and community-based services workforce shortage across the array of services that are considered home and community-based services. So those two things do coexist right now in Minnesota and nationally. So absolutely, you're making a good point that we simultaneously have an issue with workforce who can care for, you know, the folks in our communities who need those supports and services. And we also have issues in some services where we have excess licensed capacity above and beyond what the need for the service is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am struck a little bit by some of the things shared today, but just following this train of thought of the last couple of questions here, from an agency perspective, as you're looking at the licensing of these providers, what do you ask for from providers to prove that they have any level of expertise in providing this care? Or are there no qualifications that they need to have? Can they just be some individual right off the street that starts a new business in this space? What additional background are you seeking that has resulted in this large increase in number of providers?
Thanks for the question, Representative Schultz. So unfortunately, I don't have all of the statutes in front of me, but each licensed service has statutes and rules which lays out the requirements for obtaining licensure. I don't know if it's across the board, but some of those statutes do require an evaluation of competency to be made by the department. So to the extent we as a state want to look at that, and I think we should be looking at potentially raising the qualifications, raising the competency levels, raising what we expect from providers. So that's my opinion. Might not be the department's opinion, but I think anything we can do to vet on the front end to make sure that providers that are getting licenses are competent and qualified to provide these services, I am 100% on board for that and examining where those gaps may exist. But to answer your question, each of these services have different licensing requirements and different requirements about what showings need to be made in order to get licensed. And so that's another thing. So we have an incredibly complicated system with different rules across these licensed services. So thinking about how we can make it more uniform also is something I think we should work on as a state.
Representative Schultz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Inspector General, I'm glad to hear you share a lot of that. And I think that, you know, whether it's what we hear from whistleblowers or from Minnesotans, I think if we followed the precept that you outlined, we might see a higher level of care for those people too, for the people who actually need it, right? But Inspector General, I think that then brings me to something you said earlier and something I want to kind of follow down the line of. And we talk about following billing patterns. You spent a moment of the day talking about the role that counties play in collecting this information, that it's a social service individual who ultimately grants this ability for this care. What do you think, Inspector General, do we need to do? Do we need to add to statute so that there is a greater level of scrutiny that a county employee places over whether or not that individual receives care?
Inspector General Clark.
I guess I would be open, right, to that, looking at solutions. I mean, I've heard anecdotally, right, that we are seeing serious troubles with our county case management system. Folks are overworked, they're underpaid, there's high turnover. So a lot of the stuff that case managers should be seeing on the front end, correcting, reporting to the department, a lot of that stuff is falling through the cracks. So I don't know if it's a statute change, a rule change, a funding change, but thinking about Medicaid oversight as a shared responsibility, right? We have counties play a role, DHS plays a role, the federal government plays a role, the legislature plays a role, managed care organizations play a role. We need to focus on how we can strengthen everybody's role across that system, because if we have areas of responsibility that are falling short, we're going to continue to see problems, as in like not identifying these issues on the front end with recipients that aren't receiving services and making those quality tips. So I don't know if it's a statutory change. I don't know if it's a rule change, a culture change. Like, we need to strengthen the county case management system in this state, because they're really the front line of oversight in the Medicaid program. So I'm happy to partner with you or anybody on that for ideas or solutions.
Representative Schultz, last one.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say another good comment, and I appreciate that. So let's work on that together and also consider, you know, do we need additional documentation? Does that documentation from a county level need to be shared with you? Does it need to be shared with the federal government, right? These are all questions that I think that we really need to hone in on for program integrity's sake. So I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, I appreciate this great discussion. I really do. And we're going to quickly move through the next three very quickly because we do have a public testifier I still want to get to. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Very quick. What have you done about looking at attendance records? Because we saw with, for example, Feeding Our Future, it was all fake names. And, you know, in this case, they have to have account. They have to have something authorized through Medicaid, which I appreciate. We've heard from numerous county officials about the pressure that they get to approve, especially senior care and stuff that's not. So it's all fraudulent. But what have we done about the attendance records? Because if we're only going out in every 2 years and, you know, peeking to see if they have, you know, something going on, we don't know that they're actually spending 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day at what used to be a senior center, you know, years ago in some cases. So yes. What are we doing about that?
Inspector Clark.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. So reviewing attendance records is a part of our licensing site visits, right? But like you said, those don't happen every year, right? We have limited capacity. We have not only adult day, but thousands and thousands and thousands, right, of licensed Medicaid programs in the state. So periodic licensing reviews would be one way that we're looking at attendance records. Another way we would be looking at attendance records would be if we are receiving tips of fraud or potential attendance falsification. If we're receiving those tips, then fraud investigators would go out and investigate providers. But I think what you're getting at is Medicaid also is, it's a trust-based system, right? Like, we do not have the staff at DHS, we do not have the technology to be looking over everyone's shoulder, verifying every attendance record, making sure that every bill that submit to us is appropriate, right? We need to be able to trust the providers that they are doing the right thing. So what can we do on the front end to make sure that we weed out as many untrustworthy providers as possible? That's where I think we need to be focusing as a state, because what you're getting at, right, is like, we're only doing licensing reviews every couple of years, right? And then we're only responding to tips like when we get them. So what are we missing? And a part of that is we just need to be able to trust these providers that are entering our programs. So what can we do to vet, to verify that these are trustworthy businesses and individuals that we're doing business with as a state? So happy to partner with you on solutions too, but provider vetting on the front end is where we need to be focusing our efforts if we want to get ahead of fraud in our state.
Thank you, Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I want to just add on to James, Inspector General Clark's answer, that also this enhanced prepayment review is going to be helpful for claims of spotting trends and outliers and letting us know where to look. And then looking forward in the future, perhaps the legislature wants to consider electronic visit verification or something like that, but would be interested in discussing that in the coming session.
Thank you. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to save this for later, but but as I heard additional comments from the members of the majority, I wanted to bring this up. I've heard folks mention multiple whistleblowers. I heard you say that, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson referenced that, you know, we all know that there's kickbacks. Representative Schultz then most recently brought up whistleblowers. And I guess I just, and perhaps this would be a question, I don't want to put the agency in this spot, so I'll just sort of perhaps make this comment to you, Madam Chair, and members. A reminder to the public, the whistleblower portal that the chair set up, members of the minority have not had access to. And if members of the majority are aware of even one whistleblower, there's information the members have, please get it to authorities, get it to folks who can investigate and can act on it. And perhaps you've done that. And maybe I will just ask the question to the Inspector General. Are you aware of information provided by there's references to whistleblowers and kickbacks, knowledge of that, members of the committee. Are you aware of information that's been provided by members of the committee to you. I don't want to know the details, but have they passed that along to you?
Inspector General.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I am not aware of any information being forwarded to me by the committee. If the committee has information about fraud that I can use to suspend payments to providers, I am happy to meet at any time. Like, I am sick of Medicaid fraud. I want to shut off payments to any provider that is stealing from us. So if we have credible allegations of or tips that can lead to credible allegations of fraud, you can submit it through our website, but I would prefer them to come directly to me. When things do get referred to us by elected officials, they typically get raised to my attention directly. And a Representative Hudson referred a report of suspected abuse a few months ago. I ensured that that got immediate investigative assignment. So I am happy to meet with anybody on this committee privately, over the phone, so that we can stop potential criminals from gaining access to money.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to that. So we did receive your letter, Inspector General, asking us to share information with you on credible whistleblower reports. And to date, we have not, because there is no trust, as you might understand. This fraud has been perpetuated on your watch, and the whistleblowers who reach out to us within the department are terrified, and they feel that they've been retaliated against already. They feel that they are very afraid. They're afraid to reach out to us. And if they thought we were then turning around and giving it to you, we would not have whistleblowers. So we initiated a whistleblower portal last spring in response to people who were afraid to come to you. And that has received hundreds of tips. Belatedly, you all also put out a whistleblower report portal this fall, which I think hopefully is also generating tips. But when I get credible allegations of fraud from whistleblowers, we meet with them. We interview them. We ferret it out as much as possible. But as you know, legislators do not have access to bank records, health records, subpoena power, the SWIFT payment system that the state uses to pay things. So I can only get an investigation so far. But when we get it, we go to the U.S. Attorney, the FBI, and the Office of Legislative Auditor, who have access to all those records. So our whistleblowers are being protected, and they are also being reviewed for further investigation. And I would like to have a more collaborative relationship with you, but I have to say, if whistleblowers thought we were turning everything over to you, it would stop.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up question then. Madam Chair, are you referring tips to law enforcement then? It's sort of implied by your answer that you are, if I can ask. And have any been referred to law enforcement?
Multiple.
And then, Madam Chair, in that case, so the members of the minority have not seen a single, nothing submitted to that portal. I just want to confirm, is that going to continue to be your practice then? If it's credible enough to hand over to law enforcement, but you will not let fellow legislators be aware of those tips?
I have not received requests to see the trips we're handing over to law enforcement, but if you would like to be read in, I would consider it. But I want to protect my whistleblowers. That's what they're afraid of.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I think we had spoken previously about the minority's interest in receiving that information. I will point out, for many months, the whistleblower portal said that information would be shared with members of the committee. We spoke recently. That's now been changed. It's being shared just with Republican members, which I appreciate the honesty of that. But for many months, anybody submitting information to that portal thought that it was being shared with the members of the committee. That was not true. When you talk about a lack of trust, to my mind, that is really generates a lot of lack of trust. That something that people think is going to be acted upon. It's just shared with Republican members. If you find it so credible you're giving it to law enforcement, we as policymakers have no idea getting any kind of insights from any information in that portal. So yeah, I'm sorry if you did not think that before now that we had an interest in that, but service on the Fraud Prevention Committee means that we want to know anything we can do to prevent fraud. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Elkins. I appreciate that you have been waiting in line for your second question, but we are going to go to our public testifier. I would like to call up Nate Olson, and if I could ask the commissioner and team to stay, because I do have a little presentation I'm hoping to provide that I would like to ask you questions on afterward. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson. You have 2 minutes once you get organized here.
Madam Chair, committee, Minnesota people, I've heard the commissioners.
I'm sorry. I just need you to state your name for the record, Mr. Olson.
I'm sorry.
Your full name.
Sorry, ma'am. Madam Chair, I'm Nathaniel M. Olson, a disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. I've heard the commissioners and the Department of Human Services, but the one thing that I'm freaking worried about is this freaking fraud that is happening over our state, where there's 600,000 disability people in the state of Minnesota that could suffer. And sadly, it's quite interesting that we have Governor Walz speaking in front of the state and saying that this fraud is nothing beside, but my people are done suffering. We're done with this fraud. We're done with the Department of Human Services coming up here and saying, oh, we're going to figure this out. This has been too long. The administration knew that this fraud was coming. I've talked to families, parents, everyone have been reaching out to me and saying, oh, this is what is happening to my child. This is what is happening to my child. We're afraid. We need to put aside these differences, and we need to come together and put a stop to this fraud. Our governor is not doing anything to help us, but sit here and decide he wants to blame Donald J., the President of the United States, who has nothing to do with this. There is a time to hold our governor accountable, and I'm not seeing it. This fraud is outrageous. And I'm very scared for my little brother if he goes into ICS home. But right now he's home with my parents, and he's going to stay there because I'm going to keep fighting for these disability people, because none of them are right here. And I am their voice. It is time for us to say enough is enough. I'm done. And it makes me sad to see what's happening to our state. This was a great state. It was. But all of this fraud that is coming around here, all these excuses that is happening, needs to stop. Minnesota needs to become a great state again. Thank you. And thank you guys for your guys' hard work.
Thank you for coming forward, Mr. Olson. We appreciate your testimony. All right. Representative Elkins, do you want to quick ask your next question while I make my way to the testifier table?
Very quick. Thanks, Benji. I've been spending a lot of time with the counties the last couple of months, and what I can say is the counties are suffering right now. The case managers who get into this line of work because they want to help people have been turned into glorified data entry clerks just because of the kludgy systems and awful procedures that we put them through. And this is becoming a crisis that we need to be addressing as well. That's good.
Thank you. Next, we have a presentation by Chair Robbins. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I know it's a little unusual for me to come and give a presentation when we don't have a bill in front of us, but we've had multiple hearings for many months, and we have raised red flags after red flags. We've worked with the department. We've tried to talk about internal controls. And we've had months of being told in this committee that things are getting better, that they are changing processes and procedures, that red flags are being attended to. And I appreciate that progress is being made. I really do. But based on the whistleblower reports that come into our office and the meetings I've had, the meetings our researcher has had, we continue to see these networks of fraud that concern me and that are in multiple programs. So we first saw it in the Feeding Our Future. Then we saw it in autism centers. Then we saw it in housing stabilization. And now today we're looking for the first time at assisted living and adult day services. Members, we do not have the time to do this for every single program. So this is my attempt to show you what we have found in this space through our research to then beg the department and the others involved in these adult and assisted living to take this on as their next project, but then also to look more broadly at all of these services. It is incumbent on us to get a handle on it. And when you see these networks, it's a huge red flag, and it doesn't seem to have been triggered in this space yet. So we have several slides here that I'm going to walk through. The first two we've kind of addressed, so I'm just going to talk about it really quickly. The first slide here is talking about the payments in assisted living, and as was referred to earlier, assisted living and customized living. Assisted living licensure is done by the Department of Health, but the customized living services are done by DHS, so it's sort of a hybrid of responsibility. And what we are seeing in this slide is, in column one, the growth in the number of people getting customized living services in assisted living facilities has been double the growth in other waivered programs. But more importantly, you'll see the rate of payments for customized living services is 10 to 15 times the growth in other waiver payments. So this is a huge concern, members. One of the many red flags we always see is the growth in payments substantially, and we are seeing this. And the next slide, we've already talked about this quite a bit, and the department had this in one of their slides. But the growth we have seen in the number of providers. We talked about the number of providers in adult daycare. Now we're talking about the number of providers in assisted living facilities. The growth has been really large, and the growth is interestingly from, if you just look at the second part of the slide, in the provisional assisted licensing facilities, that's the growth in new programs over the last year, because they have provisional license, it's just good for one year. Strikingly, the growth is in those with five or less for capacity. And why is that? That is because the state put a moratorium on growth for four or less a couple years ago. So they all just switched and went into five or less. Members, this should be a red flag. I don't know why this is not on people's radar. So they just basically, trying to avoid the moratorium, shifted to five. And I just think this is something that has to be addressed, and I want to raise it while the department is here so that they can get back to us on that. All right, next slide, big picture. Here's the web that we have discovered, and I want to give great thanks to our researcher. For members of the public who don't know, we are a committee of five members and one researcher. And our researcher has done phenomenal work looking at publicly available documents. I'm sorry, members of the majority. We have a committee of eight. I'm sorry, my colleagues on the other side. And I believe you're a researcher. You also have a researcher on your side. So we have a majority researcher, a majority minority researcher. So our researcher has uncovered, through publicly available documents, as I said earlier, we don't have access to bank records, health records, subpoena power, any of the state payment system. This is just what we have discovered through whistleblower reports and publicly available documents. And it is a web of all these people who have multiple relationships, multiple business, multiple ownership interests that are involved in all of these Medicaid services. And when you see a web like this, and this is just a tiny one, this is such a small sample of what we could have put out, but we do not have the bandwidth to create a chart like this. This should, when you can create a web like this, it should be a red flag. So I'll talk about specific pieces of the charts. We'll go to the next chart really quickly. So members, Feeding Our Future has been the largest scandal in state and national history from COVID. And as we will see in this chart, there is a Feeding Our Future defendant who is continuing to bill the state for assisted living services while awaiting trial in the Feeding Our Future scam. First, it is outrageous that the department is still allowing a Feeding Our Future fraudster who's been alleged, you know, charged to still get state money of any kind. The state statute explicitly permits the state to stop payment where there are credible allegations of fraud. And my friends, if someone has been indicted in Feeding Our Future, that's a credible allegation of fraud, and they should not be getting state money for any other program. So let me give you the backstory. In February 2024, this person in the Feeding Our Future bubble was indicted and charged for $1.1 million in money laundering in the Feeding Our Future scandal. This same person was paid an additional $49 million for other state programs between 2019 and 2024. This person will have their trial in April of 2026. The other key player on this slide is Realtor 4, R4 on the chart. This person has shown up in our records as being the most single largest buying agent for single family homes that are converted to assisted living from anyone that we have found. R4 and the Feeding Our Future defendant are interconnected in multiple ways. Realtor 4 was the buying agent for multiple properties by the Feeding Our Future defendant. If you look at the bubble just above R4, it's Assisted Living Facility 16. You will see this. So Assisted Living Facility 16 represents three separate properties owned by the Feeding Our Future defendant and operated under a different business by the defendant's wife. This Assisted Living Facility received over $2.3 million in state money last year. The wife of the Feeding Our Future defendant just recently purchased a fourth home that will become part of Assisted Living Facility 16, again using Realtor 4, and was given a provisional license for this facility in September. Members, what is going on? This is a red flag, and they just gave them a provisional license. Incredibly, the Feeding Our Future defendant changed his name just months before he was indicted, and he used that new name to purchase the homes that are operated in Assisted Living Facility Bubble 17. Two homes that the state has paid currently in this calendar, in this fiscal year, $132,000. One of the homes purchased in that setting for that facility was purchased using the same LLC that he's indicted for money laundering in. It is unbelievable, members. And they were just granted a new operating license for this facility earlier in the year. So this is not hard to figure out. As Jim Abler said, Senator Jim Abler said back in 2024 when this person was indicted, he said, if it were me, I'd do a strict audit of the last 5 years of this man's business. People who are dishonest in one area may tend to be dishonest in another. We have to be absolutely sure. Clearly, his suggestion was ignored. All of these homes purchased or owned by the Feeding Our Future defendant are currently enrolled in DHS to deliver customized living services as late as October. Payments to the defendant's wife had continued for services on her husband's properties for 2 years following his indictment. And the payments to the Assisted Living 17, that property was founded after his indictment. We are not still getting the attention of the department to do the basic due diligence that we need. If they have not cross-checked every member of the Feeding Our Future who have been indicted or convicted and see what other services they are getting from the state, they have failed. And I'm asking them today to get that done. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, this is another realtor, and the reason this is relevant is because you'll see in their ICS bubble, they provide several services. This is the person where we had a testifier in September talking about how they were not provided services for their ICS services by this provider. So this real estate agent owns this ICS provider we talked about last month, and payments have now apparently been shut down to this provider, but last year they got $1.6 million from the taxpayer. He also owns three of these houses for assisted living. So we've shut him down in integrated community supports, but we have not shut him down for assisted living. Why is that? So $1.3 million and counting. There are two other issues that I'm going to skip over for time with this realtor. But it's important to know that this is just one example of how potential fraudulent activity is being allowed to continue in Minnesota. This lack of cross-checking of different businesses is a basic failure of internal controls, and it must stop. Now we're going to move on to person one and person two from the far section of the slide. So just just to level set, person one is related to real estate agent one, but it's not shown on here, but that was part of that larger web. So person one has been very busy. They came to our attention from a whistleblower, and then our staff later went to visit the commercial building in St. Paul that houses about 100 healthcare companies. This building was named in the FBI Housing Stabilization Affidavit for the extensive network, a very similar network of fraudulently providing housing stabilization service providers. This person's story has an interesting twist in the far left bubble. They also own a restaurant that was raided by the police for alcohol, tobacco, and gaming violations. And it was so egregious that the city of Minneapolis pulled their license and they are closed as a restaurant. So I think this is another red flag. If someone owns a business that's had multiple legal gambling and liquor violations and their license is pulled and they're still getting a lot of other money from the state, maybe we should take more scrutiny there. But and also because the addresses for their other businesses that are billing the state are the address of the restaurant. So this person has three different assisted living facilities. I'm going to quickly run through them. Assisted living facility one is administered by person one and has a capacity of 4 beds. Despite this limited capacity, they had $826,000 last year, and they are on pace to double that. We need to be concerned about that. Assisted living facility two is operated by person one. This home was purchased with cash, which is a red flag because there's a lot of money laundering going on in these spaces. It is also a homesteaded property, despite the fact that the owner already has a homestead elsewhere. Members, we see this in multiple of these assisted living facilities, where they have homesteaded the assisted living facility while they have another property homesteaded. That should be another basic internal control that is being flagged, and I have not seen evidence of that being done by the department. Later, let's see, did I talk about their third one? This one is also on track to double their payments in the next year. I'll just say briefly what's going on there. So the other interesting thing about this is this person one, is connected to person two. And person two has an adult daycare. I'm looking for my notes on that. The adult daycare bubble in this chart received over $632 million in 25. But it was uncovered that person one's adult daycare is the former location of person two's adult daycare. So two adult daycares by person one and person two were run out of the same location, both billing the state of Minnesota for 4 years. Those overlapping payments just stopped. So, and then person two has a separate assisted living facility, and there's more I could say about person two, but we're running out of time. So members, I bring this to your attention and to the department's attention because despite months of hearings, we continue to miss the most basic internal controls, the most basic checks and balances when we are enrolling providers. And I'm grateful that the day before our hearing, they've now paused enrollment for new providers in adult day services. Clearly, that's essential. But we also have to pause new providers in assisted living facilities. And I hope that we will do that. And I just want to quickly highlight the red flags that we've outlined in this one network. And members, this is just one network. Our researcher has multiple networks that we could have discussed today. And I will be turning all of that data over to the U.S. Attorney after this hearing and encourage them to look through it. But the flags that I want to highlight that have still not been addressed are the explosive growth in providers and payments in assisted living. And that as at a minimum, any business with ties to Feeding Our Future indictments should receive higher scrutiny. Any use of LLCs or other front companies used in feeding our future should be scrutinized to see if they're also still getting other state services. Any business owned by someone who's already been stopped payments on in other programs, oh, that was part of person one, should get higher scrutiny. Any person who's had overpayments, they should get higher scrutiny about other businesses they run. Any business owner should be checked to see if the owner has a history of other violations. At a minimum, do a Google search on these people who are owning businesses. I forgot to highlight some of the other things about person one, but one of them that's very intriguing is they have a mineral company in Africa, and that license is unverified. So they claim that they're also providing licensed mineral services in Africa. That should be a red flag, members. So we've highlighted, this is all information that the department claims they've cleaned up. And it's ongoing. They are getting money today in other service areas. So I just want to highlight that the work of fixing basic internal controls has not happened. And we still need to make sure, and our job is to hold the agency accountable for making sure that they are buttoning this up. I am very thankful to see that these providers are not going to be allowed to enroll new providers in these programs, but we should do that not only for adult daycare, we should do it for assisted living and probably many other programs. And for those existing providers, I personally think they should all have to be re-verified. So members, I wanted to bring this to your attention because the work of our committee, I think a lot of it the public never sees. We have these hearings. Nobody understands the networks we are uncovering, the things that our tremendous staff has found, and the hundreds of whistleblower reports we are doing. And so I just wanted to make sure the public understands we are making progress, and I appreciate the steps the department has taken, but there are ongoing problems that have not been addressed, and we need to do more to shut this down. And with that, members, I'm happy to take questions, but I also have questions based on this testimony for the department. So I'm going to retake my chair. Thank you.
Thank you. While we're waiting, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to raise a concern, which is what I have heard the Inspector General say, what I've heard others say, is tips. You can pass on tips. They don't have to have personally identifiable information. They can be anonymous, both directly and from us. So it is a concern to me to hear this committee chair say, not only are you not passing on information to the Inspector General, you're not passing on information. I didn't hear you say the Attorney General. I heard you say the administration, and so what it sounds like to me, and the concern I have, is a partisan political concern, and here's why. Because you talked about building trust, which I think is really, really important. I think it's important that as government we are building trust with our residents and our and the folks who live here. But I think it is hard to build trust when you have a committee, which one you referred to, I know it was a slip, but it's the committee of five, and there are eight of us. And so that was the Republicans. You talked about the researcher. I assume you're not sharing this with, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, our nonpartisan researcher who can hold stuff in confidence. So you're talking about your partisan researcher. The tip line is MinnesotaHouseRepublicans.com/whistleblower portal. So it's not a government, you didn't set up a legislative portal with the rules that apply. It is a partisan political tip line. This is an election year. And so the incentive structure is not, for you, Madam Chair, for others who are running against the governor, is not to fix the problem, it is to highlight and run on it. And I actually don't have a problem with that. That is the politics we live in. But when we talk about our work here and building trust with people, the idea that this committee is collecting and not sharing with the minority, not sharing with our nonpartisan infrastructure, not sharing with the Inspector General, or the Attorney General and only sharing it with the U.S. attorney who reports to somebody who's directly coming after our governor and who has said pretty terrible things is very partisan, and I think it'd be hard to argue with that. And so I think if we want to build trust, the way we start by building trust is by, one, sharing, if you can anonymize and share that with every, with the Inspector General, with the Attorney General's office, with the OLA, with the U.S. attorney, but the behavior and the way that this committee has been operating or the Republican majority on this committee is not about building trust. You don't build trust with a partisan website, with a partisan angle, and with not sharing information with two-thirds of the government. So I guess with that, I would ask, Madam Chair, do you plan on changing the way, now that you know that tips can be anonymous, sharing some of that either with the minority or with the administration and with the Attorney General's office?
Thank you, Representative Greenman. So to be clear, I share regularly with the the Office of Legislative Auditor. I work closely with our nonpartisan research staff, and it was on their advice that we had to set up the portal under the Republican side. We tried to do it through a legislative bipartisan thing, and for reasons that are beyond my technology, that was not possible. So we did look into that aggressively at the beginning. We were told the best way to do it would be through the Republican side. So we did try to do that. And to your point, suggesting that sharing with the U.S. attorney is inappropriate, the U.S. attorney's office under President Biden, under Andy Lugar, is the one who started Feeding Our Future. And we had a bipartisan meeting with the former U.S. attorney as a committee that everyone was invited to learn from him. And it was a very productive meeting. And now there has been a change of government, but the person actually prosecuting these cases in the U.S. attorney's office is the same person. And that person has fantastic integrity and cares about justice and cares about this state. And so
Madam Chair,
I do not accept that referring things to the U.S. Attorney's office is inappropriate.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify because I didn't say that. What I said is only sharing things with the U.S. Attorney's office and not sharing it with our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit at the Attorney General's office. That's charged under state and federal law with investigating this, not sharing it with the Inspector General at the department. That's what I said. It is not, I think you should be sharing these tips and you can share them anonymized with everybody. What I'm saying is you clearly make a distinction between places that are controlled by Republicans and places that are controlled by Democrats. And that to me does not, you can choose to do that. This is your committee. That does not build trust in what you're doing here. And you raised the issue of trust.
Right.
And so that's what I'm saying. And so please don't mischaracterize what I said.
Thank you. Well, you also said I didn't refer to the OLA or I hadn't worked with nonpartisan staff. And I have done both. And I continue to do both. But what I will say to regarding why I'm not sharing currently with the department and with the Office of the Attorney General is because of the trust broken with the whistleblowers. That predates this committee by years. And the whistleblowers only felt comfortable coming forward when they knew someone outside the Attorney General's office and the department was willing to listen to them, because they have tried repeatedly to share their concerns with the department and with the Attorney General's office and have either been ignored or ghosted, or they have been retaliated against, surveilled, and other problems. And so because I'm first trying to build trust with the whistleblowers, that's why we're not referring back to the department, because they are very afraid. If I begin to feel like we can do that without violating the whistleblower trust, then I would certainly want to share. And I have had meetings with Commissioner Gandhi privately in my office over the months, and we have a good dialogue. I also think what would build trust is responses to my inquiries. So after every hearing since June, I've sent letters to the department asking for additional data. I've had one response, and it was after a press inquiry. So I have 6 outstanding data requests to the department that I'm still waiting for information on. So it would help build trust if you would respond to me. So we will continue to work on building trust, and I really mean that, but it has to be a two-way street.
Madam Chair, just one thing actually on the practicality, because when you share with the U.S. With the Inspector General, they can shut off payment. The U.S. Attorney and the OLI can't. So as it relates to taxpayer dollars, if there are credible allegations that need to, even atomize, need to go to the Inspector General, and you are not turning them in, it is actually means that you are preventing payments from being stopped. And so, again, I think there is this, like, what I am asking for is not that you only go to them. What I am saying is that the Inspector General has a role to play here, and they have been playing that role. The OLA has a role to play here, and I think we heard it. We have a role to play here. But, again, you made a lot of comments about a lot of things happening, none of which you provided to the minority. And so, again, to build trust with us, but also with the public, you have said a lot of things. You have not put facts. If there's allegations of surveillance, you should bring that up. That's a potentially a law enforcement thing. But just saying that in a public hearing does not, one, build trust, and it also doesn't build our credibility. And that's, I think, the stake we should all have in this. Thank you.
Thank you. And my final comment on that is we will continue to work together to build trust, and I will continue to protect the whistleblowers. If you are watching, I have your back, and you will always be protected. And I will continue to look for ways to help provide information where we should stop payment as appropriate. And I think I've given you plenty of opportunity to look at things this afternoon where I do think, and I've recommended strongly, we look at other places to stop payment, and I hope you will take it seriously. With that, members, we're adjourned. Thank you.